after almost 8 years of researching and talking about Mormon issues and considering myself post-Mormon for a number of those years, I was pretty confident that I had heard virtually every issue that's out there regarding the church. But then a few months ago, a friend came to me and told me that I had to read something. I was sure that whatever he had to tell me, I already knew. But that wasn't the case. I'm Matt Long, and on this episode of Infants on Thrones, we're going to cover the information that my friend showed me, something that was new to me and that was new to some of my fellow infants. And if that's the case, it just might be new to you.
This is Infants on Thrones.
Minisode.
So back to my friend. I was pretty impressed with myself that I've been doing this about 8 years. What I'd forgotten is my friend's been doing this for closer to 20. So this guy was able to draw some conclusions before the internet. We were talking one day about issues about the church, and he had asked me if I knew anything about Lowry Nelson, and I'd never heard of him. He told me I needed to Google it, I needed to look it up, and read the letters between Lowry Nelson and some leaders of the church. I didn't do it. A couple months later, we were talking again, and he asked if I had read it. I hadn't. So he told me to pull it up right then and start reading. And these letters blew my mind. But they also introduced me to my new hero of Mormonism, Lowry Nelson. I immediately sent a link to these letters to the guys at Infants on Thrones and suggested we do our signature smackdown. But fortunately, Glenn had a better idea. These letters don't need any commentary. They stand alone. All you need to do is read them. That's what we decided to do. Just read the letters without comment, without commentary, and without sound effects. Maybe. Because the letters really do speak for themselves. The people that were involved in this correspondence included Lowry Nelson, who was a professor at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Agriculture. You'll also hear letters written by President Heber Meeks, a mission president, as well as letters from the First Presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which at that time was comprised of George Albert Smith, J. Reuben Clark, and David O. McKay. You'll also hear letters from Joseph Anderson, who was the secretary to the First Presidency. Glenn Ostlund will be playing the role of Lowry Nelson. Matt Long will be playing the role of the First Presidency. Jake Frost will be playing the role of President Heber Meeks. And the role of Joseph Anderson will be played by John Hamer. Enjoy.
Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Office of the Southern States Mission, 485 North Avenue Northeast, Atlanta 5, Georgia, June 20th, 1947. Letter from Heber Meeks, Mission President, to Dr. Lowry Nelson, University of Minnesota, Minneapolis, Minnesota. Dear Lowry, a short time ago, at the request of the First Presidency, I visited Cuba in view of doing some missionary work on that island. While there, I met Mr. Chester W. Young, who was in Havana representing the Nation Office of Vital Statistics Pan-American Sanitary Bureau. He was very helpful to us, and in the course of our conversation, I learned that he was well acquainted with you and wished to be remembered to you. We found both his wife and him to be very delightful and charming people. He advised me that you spent some 2 years in Cuba making a study of rural communities. Your study there would be very helpful to us. I would appreciate your opinion as to the advisability of doing missionary work, particularly in the rural sections of Cuba, knowing, of course, our conception of the Negro and his position as to the priesthood. Are there groups of pure white blood in the rural sections, particularly in the small communities? If so, are they maintaining segregation from the Negroes? Our best information we received was that in rural communities there was no segregation of the races, and it would probably be difficult to find, with any degree of certainty, groups of pure white people. I would like your reaction as to what progress you think the church might be able to make in doing missionary work in Cuba in view of, particularly in the rural section, the ignorance and superstition of the people and their being so steeped in Catholicism. Do you think our message would have any appeal to them? My observation, and we may make some very fine contacts with outstanding leaders in many of these fields of activity, was that the urban communities are groups to which we could make an appeal, particularly with the youth program of the church. Many of the leaders expressed themselves that there would be a great need for such a program as the church has in their communities. I assure you, I will deeply appreciate any information you can give me along the lines as indicated. With kindest personal regards and best wishes, I am sincerely your brother, signed Hiram Meeks, Mission President.
University of Minnesota, Department of Agriculture, University Farm, St. Paul, June 26, 1947. To President Hiram Meeks, 485 North Avenue, Northeast, Atlanta, Georgia. Dear Hiram, it is nice to have word of you after so many years. I am writing this, as you see, from our alma mater, where I am teaching the first term of the summer session. A thousand memories of student days flood in upon me every day. It is pleasant to see old friends and to make new ones among those who have joined the staff since I left. Yes, I spent a year in the Caribbean from September 1945 to September 1946. Most of my time was spent in Cuba, but I managed to get to some of the other islands as well. I have nearly completed a book about Cuba, but it will be some time before it is published. I was pleased to have word of my friend Chester Young, whom I saw in Havana, and also in Santo Domingo during my year down there. The attitude of the church in regard to the Negro makes me very sad. Your letter is the first intimation I have had that there was a fixed doctrine on this point. I had always known that certain statements had been made by authorities regarding the status of the Negro, but I had never assumed that they constituted an irrevocable doctrine. I hope no final word has been said on this matter. I must say, I've never been able to accept the idea, and never shall. I do not believe that God is a racist, but if the church has taken an irrevocable stand, I would dislike to see it enter Cuba or any other island where different races live and establish missionary work. The white and colored people get along much better in the Caribbean and most of Latin America than they do in the United States. Prejudice exists, there is no doubt, and the whites in many ways manifest their feelings of superiority, but there is much less of it than one finds in the USA, especially in our South. For us to go into a situation like that and preach a doctrine of white supremacy would, it seems to me, be a tragic disservice. I am speaking frankly because I feel very keenly on this question. If world brotherhood and the universal God idea mean anything, it seems to me they mean equality of races. I fail to see how Mormonism or any other religion claiming to be more than a provincial church can take any other point of view. And there cannot be world peace until the pernicious doctrine of the superiority of one race and the inferiority of others is rooted out. This is my belief. In reference to Catholicism, while the Cubans are nominally Roman Catholic, they take their religion rather lightly. Wherever I went, I asked rural people about the church, and invariably they told me they saw the priest only once a year, when he came around to baptize the babies at $3 a head, like branding the calves at the annual roundup. Some families have crucifixes and other paraphernalia in their homes and carry on something of the ancient ritual, but my impression is that it means little to most of them. The Methodists, Presbyterians, and Baptists have, as you know, done a great deal of missionary work on the island, and have rendered Cuba a great service in maintaining schools, hospitals, etc. However, they have limited their work largely to the urban centers. There is a great service to be rendered rural Cubans if the right approach were made. Mormonism is well adapted to render such service with its system of lay leadership and many activity programs. Many rural Cubans have nothing in the way of organized social life. To them, the family is the basic institution, and beyond that, the neighborhood. Our church would provide them with something very sorely needed. It would develop leadership among them, provide them with hope and aspiration, give them a feeling of importance as individuals which they never had. They have been exploited by priests and politicians. They have been led to believe that the government is not any of their responsibility, and that the church is the business of the priest and the bishop. While there is a great deal of individualism among them, they have definite and discernible feelings of inferiority when it comes to matters of leadership. I am talking about the white people now. The rural people are predominantly white. That is, they are as white as Mediterranean peoples are, Spanish, Italians, etc., who have been in contact with color for centuries. The Moors occupied Spain, you know, for 7 centuries. There are no pure races. On this, anthropologists are in general agreement. Of course, this does not mean that Negro blood exists throughout the white race, or vice versa. There is grave doubt, however, as to the purity of the Nordic, Mediterranean, or even the Negro. Because I think our system of religious organization could serve the rural Cuban people as no other system could, I am sad to have to write you and say, for what my opinion is worth, that it would be better for the Cubans if we did not enter their island, unless we are willing to revise our racial theory, to teach them the pernicious doctrine of segregation and inequalities among races where it does not exist, or to lend religious sanction to it where it has raised its ugly head. Well, that would, it seems to me, be quite tragic. It seems to me we just fought a war over such ideas. I repeat, my frankness, or bluntness as you will, is born of a fervent desire to see the causes of war rooted out of the hearts of men. What limited study I have been able to give the subject leads me to the conclusion that ethnocentrism and the smugness and intolerance which accompany it is one of the first evils to be attacked if we are to ever achieve the goal of peace. I trust you will understand my writing you as I have. Sincerely, Lowry Nelson, C.C., President George Albert Smith. University of Minnesota, Department of Agriculture, University Farm, St. Paul, June 26, 1947. To President George Albert Smith, 47 East South Temple, Salt Lake City, Utah. Dear President Smith, I am in receipt today of a letter from President Heber Meeks, an old school friend, a copy of which I am enclosing together with a copy of my reply. It is self-explanatory. Perhaps I am out of order, so to speak, in expressing myself as I have. I have done so out of a strong conviction on the subject, and with the added impression that there is no irrevocable church doctrine on this subject. I am not unaware of statements and impressions which have been passed down, but I had never been brought face to face with the possibility that the doctrine was finally crystallized. I devoutly hope that such crystallization has not taken place. The many good friends of mixed blood, through no fault of theirs, incidentally, which I have in the Caribbean, and who know me to be a Mormon, would be shocked indeed if I were to tell them my church relegated them to an inferior status. As I told Heber, there is no doubt in my mind that our church could perform a great service in Cuba, particularly in the rural areas. But it would be far better that we not go in at all than to go in and promote racial distinction. I want you to know my feelings on this question and trust you will understand the spirit in which I say these things. I want to see us promote love and harmony among peoples of the earth. Sincerely, Lowry Nelson.
Copy: Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Office of the First Presidency, Salt Lake City No. 1, Utah, July the 1st, 1947. Dear Dr. Nelson, your letter of June the 26th, addressed to President Smith, has been received. However, it did not contain a copy of your letter to President Meeks. If you will send me a copy of that letter, I shall then be in a position to bring your communication to the attention of the President. The matter is incomplete without this letter. Faithfully yours, signed, Joseph Anderson, Secretary to the First Presidency.
July 17th, 1947. Letter addressed to Dr. Lowry Nelson, Utah State Agricultural College, Logan, Utah. Dear Brother Nelson, as you have been advised, your letter of June 26 was received in due course, and likewise we now have a copy of your letter to President Meeks. We have carefully considered their contents and are glad to advise you as follows. We make this initial remark. The social side of the restored gospel is only an incident of it. It is not the end thereof. The basic element of your ideas and concepts seems to be that all God's children stand in equal position before Him in all things. Your knowledge of the gospel will indicate to you that this is contrary to the very fundamentals of God's dealings with Israel, dating from the time of His promise to Abraham regarding Abraham's seed and their position vis-a-vis God Himself. Indeed, some of God's children were assigned to superior positions before the world was formed. We are aware that some higher critics do not accept this, but the church does. Your position seems to lose sight of the revelations of the Lord touching the pre-existence of our spirits, the rebellion in heaven, and the doctrines that our birth into this life and the advantages under which we may be born have a relationship in the life heretofore. From the days of the prophet Joseph, even until now, it has been the doctrine of the church, never questioned by any of the church leaders, that the Negroes are not entitled to the full blessings of the gospel. Furthermore, your ideas, as we understand them, appear to contemplate the intermarriage of the Negro and white races, a concept which has heretofore been most repugnant to most normal-minded people, from the ancient patriarchs till now. God's rule for Israel, His chosen people, has been endogamous. Modern Israel has similarly directed. We are not unmindful of the fact that there is a growing tendency, particularly among some educators, as it manifests itself in this area, toward the breaking down of race barriers in the matter of intermarriage between whites and blacks. But it does not have the sanction of the church and is contrary to church doctrine. Faithfully yours, signed, George Albert Smith, J. Reuben Clark Jr., David O. McKay, the First Presidency.
University of Minnesota, Department of Agriculture, University Farm, St. Paul, October 8, 1947. To the First Presidency of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, 47 East South Temple, Salt Lake City, Utah. Dear Brethren, your letter of July 17th sent to me at Logan was forwarded here, but I had already left for Europe and so did not get it until I returned to my office September 8th. I want to thank you for it, for the attention you gave me. The letter is, however, a disappointment to me, as you may surmise it would be from what I said in my letter to President Meeks. It seems strange to me in retrospect, as it must have seemed to you, that I should have never before had to face up to this doctrine of the church relative to the Negro. I remember that it was discussed from time to time during my boyhood and youth, in priesthood meetings or elsewhere in church classes, and always someone would say something about the Negroes sitting on the fence during the council in heaven. They did not take a stand, it was said. Somehow there was never any very strong conviction manifest regarding the doctrine, perhaps because the question was rather an academic one to us in Farron, where there were very few people who had ever seen a Negro, let alone having lived in the same community with them. So the doctrine was always passed over rather lightly, I should say, with no scripture ever being quoted or referred to regarding the matter, except perhaps to refer to the curse of Cain, or of Ham and Canaan. I went back and reread the latter the other evening. It was difficult to find any element of justice in Noah's behavior toward Ham, since the latter merely reported to his brothers that his father was lying there in a drunken state and in a nude condition, and the other boys put a cover over him. Because Ham reported his father's condition, he was cursed? But anyway, I really had never come face to face with the issue until this summer. In the meantime, since my youth, I have chosen to spend my professional career in the field of the social sciences, the general purpose of which is to describe and understand human behavior. I probably should have had less difficulty with some of these problems, such as the race problem, had I remained in agronomy or chemistry, my undergraduate fields and specialization. Be that as it may, my experience has been what it has been. As a sociologist, I have sincerely tried, and am still trying, to understand human social relations, the varied forms of organization, the process of conflict, cooperation, competition, assimilation, why peoples and cultures differ one from another, etc. As one studies the history and characteristics of human societies, one soon comes to recognize certain basic principles. One of these is social change. Any given society over the years undergoes changes. It is forever in a state of flux. Some scholars have regarded the change as progress and have even considered that progress is inevitable. Others chart the rise and fall of civilizations and think in terms of cyclical change. Others express still different hypotheses, but none of them consider society as a static entity. Another principle which stands out as one studies the development of cultures is the tendency of institutions to resist change. Although they are established or grow up originally as a means to the end of satisfying the needs of man, they, the institutions, tend to become ends in and of themselves. It seems to me that Jesus was trying to get this point over to the society of his day when he spoke of putting new wine in old bottles, and that the Sabbath was made for man and not man for the Sabbath. This was an affront to the legalism of the Pharisees and others of similar outlook, and of course, the institutions had to be protected even at the cost of his crucifixion. Another principle that has come to occupy a central position in the analysis of human behavior is that of ethnocentrism. As defined by William Graham Sumner, who first developed the concept, it refers to the view of things in which one's own group is the center of everything, and all others are sealed and rated with reference to it. The Folkways, page 13. Insofar as the out-group differs from the in-group, it is regarded as inferior by the latter. A people with a different skin color would automatically be assigned to an inferior status. A language different from that of the in-group is, of course, an inferior one, and so on. This tendency is common to all groups. Now, what does this all add up to in my thinking? It means that, one, if one accepts the principle of cultural or social change and applies it to the Hebrews, the Old Testament history of the group is interpreted accordingly. In their early stages of development, they had beliefs and practices, many of which were subsequently supplanted by other ideas. Jehovah to the Hebrews of the Pentateuch was essentially a tribal deity. It was not until Amos that the idea of a universal God was proclaimed, and the concept of God as love was an essential contribution of the mission of the Savior. Number two, this to me represents a progressive revelation. It seems to me that we still have much to learn about God, and some of our earlier notions of Him may yet undergo modification. Number three, the early Hebrew notion of the colored people with whom they had contact in the Mediterranean basin was, quite naturally, that those people were inferior to themselves, a consequence of their extreme ethnocentrism. Why did they not have something to say about the Japanese or Chinese or the American Indian? To me, the answer is that they did not know these groups existed. But one can be pretty certain that if they had known about them, they would have developed some similar explanation regarding their origin to that concerning the Negro. and would have assigned them also to a position less exalted than their own. Number four. And once these things got written down, institutionalized, they assumed an aura of the sacred. I refer in this respect not only to the scriptures, but to more secular documents as well. The Constitution of the United States, for instance, which many people do not want to change regardless of the apparent needs. So we are in the position, it seems to me, of accepting a doctrine regarding the Negro, which was enunciated by the Hebrews during a very early stage in their development. Moreover, and this is the important matter to me, it does not square with what seems an acceptable standard of justice today, nor with the letter or spirit of the teachings of Jesus Christ. I cannot find any support for such doctrine of inequality in his recorded sayings. I am deeply troubled. Having decided through earnest study that one of the chief causes of war is the existence of ethnocentrism among the peoples of the world, that war is our major social evil which threatens to send all of us to destruction, and that we can ameliorate these feelings of ethnocentrism by promoting understanding of one people by others, I am now confronted with this doctrine of my own church, which says in effect that white supremacy is part of God's plan for his children, that the Negro has been assigned by him to be a hewer of wood and a drawer of water for his white-skinned brethren. This makes us nominal allies of the Rankins and the Bilbos of Mississippi, a quite unhappy alliance for me, I assure you. This doctrine, pressed to its logical conclusion, would say that Dr. George Washington Carver, the late eminent and saintly Negro scientist, is by virtue of the color of his skin inferior even to the least admirable white person, not because of the virtues he may or may not possess, but because through no fault of his own there is a dark pigment in his skin. All of the people of India, who are not Negroes according to the ethnological authority but are Aryan, would presumably come under the Negro classification. I think of the intelligent, high-minded, clean-living Hindu who was a member of the international committee over which I had the honor to preside at Geneva from August 4th to 10th this year. He drank not, spoke not. His ethical standards were such that you and I could applaud him. Where should he rank vis-a-vis the least reliable and least admirable white person in Farron? Or I could name you a real Negro with equal qualifications. Now, you say that the social side of the restored gospel is only an incident of it. It is not the end thereof. I may not have the same concept of social as you had in mind, but it seems to me that the only virtues we can recognize in men are those expressed in their relations with others, that is, their social relations. These are the virtues of honesty, chastity, humility, forgiveness, tolerance, love, kindness, justice. Are they secondary? If so, what is primary? Love of God? Very well. But the second law is like unto it. I must beg your forgiveness for this intrusion upon your time. I realize that I am only one among hundreds of thousands with whom you have to be concerned. My little troubles, I must try to work out for myself. But I desire to be understood. That's why I have gone to such length to set down here the steps in my thinking. I am trying to be honest with myself and with others. I am trying to find my way in what is a very confused world. After seeing the devastation of Europe this summer, I am appalled by the sight of it and the contemplation of what mankind can collectively do to himself unless somehow we, collectively, the human family, can put love of each other above hatred and somehow come to a mutual respect based upon understanding and recognize that others, although they may be different from us, are not by that fact alone inferior. Are we becoming so legalistic, after the fashion of the Pharisees, that we cannot adjust our institutions to the changing needs of mankind? Are we, as some have charged, more Hebraic than Christian? Sincerely, your brother, Lowry Nelson, Professor of Sociology.
November 12th, 1947. Letter addressed to Dr. Lowry Nelson, University of Minnesota, Department of Agriculture, University Farm, St. Paul 1, Minnesota. Dear Brother Nelson, we have your letter of October 8 in further development of the matter discussed in your earlier letter. We feel very sure that you understand well the doctrine of the church. They are either true or not true. Our testimony is that they are true. Under these circumstances, we may not permit ourselves to be too much impressed by the reasonings of men, however well-founded they may seem to be. We should like to say this to you in all kindness and in all sincerity, that you are too fine a man to permit yourself to be led off from the principles of the gospel by worldly learning. You have too much of a potentiality for doing good, and we therefore prayfully hope that you can reorient your thinking and bring it in line with the revealed word of God. Faithfully yours, the First Presidency. Signed, G. Albert Smith.
The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Office of the First Presidency, Salt Lake City, No. 1, Utah, May the 23rd, 1952. Dear Brother Nelson, your letter, without date, addressed to President McKay, was duly received, with which you transmitted an article which you say you intend to publish. President McKay wishes me to say that, obviously, you are entirely within your rights to publish any article you wish. I should like to add on my own account, however, that when a member of the church sets himself up against doctrines preached by the prophet Joseph Smith and by those who have succeeded him in the high office which he held, he is moving into a very dangerous position for himself personally. Sincerely yours, signed, Joseph Anderson, Secretary to the First Presidency.
This is where the party ends. I can't stand here listening to you and your racist friend.
This is Ashley from North Yorkshire, England, and I have finished my final year of a psychology degree in London. So watch out, infants, a psychologist is listening. You can comment on this episode on the website infantsonthrones.com, and if you really like what you hear, give the Quorum a 5-star rating and write a short review on iTunes. Anyone for the closing prayer?
But I feel like a hypocrite talking to you and your racist friend.
He is moving into a very dangerous position. Jesus, this is hard to say.
Thank you for listening to
Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones.